Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. Well, are we going over a fiscal cliff or not? Is this just ranting and raving in politics? Is it really economics? We'll talk about that in the next half an hour. Remind you on the way to this conversation, the Mark Steiner Show is sponsored in part by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development, where their Maryland Mortgage Program can help in the purchase of a new home. To honor the Veterans Day holiday in November, active military members and veterans should know about the Maryland Homefront Mortgage Program. Former and current service members who are in the market for a new home can take advantage of a discounted interest rate mortgage and down payment and closing cost assistance. Learn more by visiting mmprogram.org or by calling 800-638-7781. We are joined here this evening in studios, Dr. Steven Isberg, who's been a guest on the show many times before, Associate Professor of Finance at the University of Baltimore. Good to see you, Steve.
Good to be back, Mark.
Dr. Robin Hanel is with us. He is Professor Emeritus of Economics at American University and Visiting Professor of Economics at Portland State University. And Robin Hanel, welcome. Good to have you with us as well.
It's great to be on your show.
So let's begin this. And I this is, you know, depending on whose newspaper you read and whose column you read, we are either going to be on this fiscal cliff, we're going to fall over and fall into the abyss with rising taxes and cutting of budgets. The austerity will take place in a drastic way if they don't come to an agreement. Another saying that this whole thing is not a fiscal danger at all, that we are talking too much about deficits. We need to be talking about investing more in the country. So this is there's a real, and we're not sure if that debate will even take place between the president and Congress, or if we're all on the same page, just slightly different tunes on the same page. So let me start with our phone guest, Robin Hanel, first, and then we'll go to Steve Isberg.
Well, I can start by simply saying that I agree with the view that you stated, that there is not a serious fiscal cliff, that this is all about politics and it's all about priority. In the long run, it's true. What we've been doing is cutting the taxes for the wealthy and insisting on continuing to pay for a military-industrial complex, pretending that there are important large wars out there that we might have to fight. Now, as long as we continue to do that, spend more on the military and cut taxes on the wealthy, of course that doesn't add up. Of course that produces deficits. But, of course, that's exactly what the Republicans who are screaming about the deficit, they're the ones responsible for that. It began back with Ronald Reagan, and every Republican president and Congress has continued to want to do that, and then at the same time say that they are worried about deficits, they're worried about the debt. The truth of the matter is that in the long run, our economy is more productive now than it was in the past. That means we can afford more than we could in the past. That means the whole idea that we have to give away the welfare state, that we have to pare back Social Security, pare back Medicare, that our children have to put up with worse and worse-funded public schooling than we did, it's all nonsense. That's all priorities. It's simply somebody else saying, no, we want our tax cuts, we want our money for the military, and everybody else is going to have to, you know, give up things they've had in the past. And in the short run, there certainly is no fiscal cliff. For some countries in Europe, the deficits that they're running are producing immediate problems because the bond markets are telling them that they can only continue to borrow at very, very high prohibitive interest rates. But we are borrowing still at rock-bottom basement interest rates. So in the short run, there is no constraint on our ability to go ahead and then to try and pull ourselves out of this recession and prevent ourselves from going back in it. So there's no problem in the short run. And in the long run, it is simply an issue of priorities. Whether we want to have domestic spending or we want to continue to have tax cuts for the wealthy and money for the military only.
Steve Isberg, your take, and then we'll throw some questions in here.
I think we need to come to a very clear understanding of what's meant by this concept of fiscal cliff. What happened when the Congress and the president couldn't agree on budget cuts? The way they resolved the situation was to institute a sequestering process where if they don't reach a new budget agreement by the end of this year, certain number of cuts will automatically go into place, not by choice, as the according to the law that they've passed. And this is the fiscal cliff that everybody's referring to. If they don't meet some kind of agreement, then we do fall off this cliff because these cuts will automatically take place. Now, one way around that would be we get together, Congress gets together with the president and agrees on a better set of cuts. The other way is, you know, we increase the debt ceiling again. And, of course, not increasing the debt ceiling may mean that the United States government starts to default on some of its payments because its revenues are shorter than its expenses and it would have to cut something, have to not make payments that it's obligated to pay. And yes, while it does come down to an issue of priorities, it always comes down to an issue of priorities when you start mixing politics and economics like we have. You know, one of the things we have to be careful about is thinking in terms of productivity gains and losses. While the economy may be more productive than it was 20 or 30 years ago, a lot of that productivity can be attributed to capital increasing in productivity, whereas labor gains and productivity haven't grown quite as quickly. And, you know, that's been reflected in declining real wages for employees, for human labor. And, you know, the question is, if we're going to raise taxes, where do we go into the tax base to get it? And what do we define as wealthy and rich? And the top 20% of income earners in this country, that category starts at $100,000 in family income a year. So if we consider the rich to be the top 20%, you know, we're going to go after a lot of people who are occupying places in the middle class of this country. To get to the top 40% of income earners, family income of $80,000 or above. So, you know, as I look at where the tax revenue sources are, you know, you can't avoid the conversation that the middle class, at least the upper end of the middle class, will have to bear a certain burden of this tax increase somewhere along the line.
But a couple questions here about what you both have just been talking about. And folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888. Don't forget to get your questions and ideas and thoughts at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com, or you can just jump on our Facebook pages and write something there. We'll get your comments in the air that way, but 410-319-8888. So let's take a couple of things here. First, before we come to the what – you just raised Steve Isberg, and I want to talk about how you pay for the American people want. That's something we have to talk about. But before that, this battle going on between the president and you, and the Congress right now, the conversations going on between them, whatever they are, or something in between that, is it your perspectives or not that what we're seeing is just a battle around who can create the greater austerity measures, the greater kind of cuts, or is this really a battle about the future of the economics of the United States of America? And that's part of the problem, and I think people have. And you see, for want of a better term, more progressive senators just being elected to the U.S. Senate saying the right questions are not being even raised here. And what we're just talking about is, do we continue cutting the programs in America? And what would a compromise mean? Does that mean more cuts? Where do you take another trillion dollars out of the U.S. budget? Who loses? So very quickly, Steve, and then Robin.
Well, the real question is, to what degree do we want the government to be responsible for our economic well-being as individuals and as society? And to what degree do we want the government to play a role in, you know, creating growth opportunities in the economy? The immediate danger of the fiscal cliff is if these cuts take effect automatically, then there will be huge reverberations throughout the economy. We've already seen a few employers announce reductions in force because they expect certain cuts to be made. You know, Boeing laid off a large group of employees the other day, and that's thought to be one of the reasons that they expect cuts to come into the defense industry. You know, if you take a look at the composition of the federal budget and, you know, where that money goes, most of it goes back to individuals in the form of some kind of an income or healthcare support, Social Security, Medicare, and we've already made a commitment as a nation to spend more on healthcare. So, you know, we voiced that as a priority now. The real question is, well, how are we going to pay for this? Are we going to pay for this by giving up spending in other areas? Can we afford to give up defense spending? Are we that safe in a world where, you know, we've got one of our major rivals here economically now thinking about building aircraft carriers and nuclear submarines? a lot of deep issues, and the real overriding issues: to what degree do we want government to be involved in different areas of our life?
Robin?
Yes. Look, the fiscal cliff was a piece of political blackmail by the Republican Party, and the whole negotiation has essentially, changed the conversation about what our national priorities should be and what we should be doing, to have us instead debating something that is absolute, insane suicide. Where I agree with Professor Nesbitt is that to go ahead, and have these automatic cuts go into effect is insane. It's very counterproductive. It will. I know that the wisdom out there right now is the recession is over. We've come out of the recession. We're in recovery. And technically, given how you define recession, that is true. But this is certainly, largely a jobless recovery. Coming out of a recession when people don't get their jobs back, really isn't worth very much, is it? So we still have a major unemployment problem, and to have these cuts go into effect would essentially throw our economy, or certainly risk throwing our economy, back into an even more, even a worse recessionary tailspin. So, no, of course that's not in the national interest. But who is it that is forcing that agenda? The Republicans have said, if you don't allow us to make permanent tax cuts for the wealthy, and if you don't allow us to maintain and continue to expand a military budget, then we are going to go ahead and, wreak this havoc upon the U.S. economy. That's what's happening. Now, the president made a terrible mistake, basically giving into that kind of blackmail a year ago, which is how we got this piece of legislation. Now it's still looming over our heads. He has got to, whether he will or he won't is what we're going to see. But he essentially has to stand. The national interest would be served if he would stand up to this blackmail and say, no, we simply will not be blackmailed into giving you what the voters just said they don't want, which is a priority for tax cuts for the wealthy and a priority for the military instead of terrible domestic needs that we are going unfulfilled. That's what the voters just voted for. The president needs to say that's what this government needs to give them. And no, I'm not going to give in to this kind of a blackmail.
So, Steve, a quick comment from you, because a lot of people are calling in. They have questions about this, and if you have a response to what Robin was just saying.
Well, the budget talks broke down, and I could see a political advantage to both sides allowing this question to be deferred. I think had major cuts been instituted and or tax increases of any kind, I think it would have weakened President Obama's chances of being reelected and weakening the Democratic Party's chances of at least holding on to control of the Senate, if not losing more seats in the House. And I do agree that there's
this.
I do agree.
It
would have weakened the economy substantially, which is something they are very, very hesitant to do in an election year. And I do agree to an extent that this was an act of blackmail. I mean, it is a combination of blackmail, but they've had 4 years to deal with a lot of these issues, too, and they haven't gotten to the point where they can agree on what to do.
Well, I have a question about what both of you think should be done. What questions are not being asked and should be asked? Let me go to the phones here. People will have questions of their own at 410-319-8888. Yvette, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I am so confused about the so-called entitlement, Social Security and Medicare. First of all, that's an inappropriate name for it. It's not entitlement. It's no different than a 401k. If you've worked, you've paid into it. I've worked for over 35 years, and I've paid into it. So why is that an entitlement to me if I'm going to use my money when I retire?
The words we use are very important, Yvette. I'm glad you raised it. I've raised this issue on the phone before, on the air before. And when we talk, very quickly from both of you, Robin and Steve, when we talk about an issue of entitlements, it sounds like you're being given something you don't deserve.
Yeah, and you didn't hear me use the word entitlement. What you're talking about, and what's her name again?
Yvette.
What you're talking about is the government's running the largest unfunded pension program in the history of mankind. You know, typically if you're an intelligent person and you want to set up a pension program for retirees, as those retirees pay in, you invest that in a fund that's able to distribute the benefits on the other end. And, you know, the federal government is not doing this. It's basically supporting the distribution of the payments with current revenues, like many companies are doing. And when General Motors did the same thing, they were driven into bankruptcy. So I agree with your perspective, and I share your pain there.
I'm going to have to take exception with that. Look, Social Security, when it was set up, was never set up the way a personal pension plan was set up. Social Security was set up in a way where people started to receive their benefits who barely had worked at all when it was originally set up. So it's people working now whose money is going in. But there is a social compromise here. There is, I mean, if you want to talk about contracts, the contract with the American people has been, you know, dating back for 40 years now. You work, I'm 66 years old. I started working and contributing to Social Security when I was 16 years old. Every year I was making payments into Social Security. I am now entitled to what I was always promised, which is a certain stream of benefits until I die. That's a contract that the American government made with the American people. It was not a frivolous contract.
Right.
It was not one that was economically unsound, and it's one that's worked well. And basically, there are some people in this country who politically have hated it from the beginning and who would like to use this excuse to dismantle it. And I certainly sympathize with the caller when she says, I've paid into this all my life. I don't see why it is that somebody is telling me somehow, well, this is something that can be taken away from you.
These are both very important points. Let's go back to our phones. We might have our callers at 410-319-8888. Siobhan, you're on the air.
LaVon, I think if I'm speaking.
Yes, you are. Welcome.
I just had a question about why it was never really emphasized how when the debt ceiling is a normal process that is generally done in every presidency. I mean, all presidents have raised the debt ceiling more than five times in their term of a four-year term. And the crisis that we faced, you know, with the debt ceiling and now the fiscal cliff and the sequester and all of that, these are artificial, manufactured crises that were created on things that were generally normal things. Why wasn't that emphasized that it was a, you know, that these were artificially manufactured? And now all four of these things are coming up against the wall that they had to kind of move quickly on because they did everything they could to make sure that he was a one-term presidency. Now they have to deal with the reality of we have to move quickly or the economy is going to sink again, which will be manufactured this time.
Interesting points.
Well, I agree with your perspective in that this problem has been a long time in developing. I mean, you can go back, you know, this government has not run a surplus very often since the Great Depression. You know, we ran a few surpluses back in the mid to late 1990s. But the federal debt has been accumulating and accumulating and accumulating for many years. And, you know, rather than confront the problem when it becomes a problem, what we've done is we've deferred it. And, you know, raising the debt ceiling, as you point out, is just another way of deferring the problem. I don't necessarily agree that the crises are manufactured. You know, every politician has to respond to crises. And interestingly enough, you can find that, you know, and in I think what you're saying is that when we have a crisis, politicians get stronger because they have to assert themselves. So why not create some crises? I think if you were to ask President Obama, would you rather have this crisis or not, he would say in a minute, no. I'd much rather be able to be free to do something about health care and, you know, cleaning up the environment and making this world a better place for everyone to live. I think he'd rather have that problem to deal with than a two-front war and an economy that's in the trash bin.
On the way back to the phones, I wanted to, unless Robin, you want to jump in on that as well.
The sad thing is that because of the political discourse, we are essentially arguing over the wrong thing.
Uh-huh.
What we need to be doing right now is actually having a fiscal stimulus. We don't have the unemployment rate down. The European economies are, you know, in further decline. The Chinese economy is slowed down. The global economy is in serious danger of going back into a recession that might be as good, might be even worse than the one that we just came through. What we need in this country is a fiscal stimulus, and this whole thing is basically a political game to keep us from having any chance of doing that. That's essentially what it's been about, you know, over the past 3 or 4 years. We should be talking about a Green New Deal. We have two monstrous crises, and our president has never understood how serious both of them are. He has constantly listened to advisors who said, oh, this recession is going to go away. You don't have to do anything extraordinary. Well, that wasn't true, and it hasn't gone away. And we have climate change looming. If we do not do a massive job of rebooting our economy and making it energy efficient and switching over from fossil fuels to renewables, we are in serious danger of boiling ourselves to death in the next 20 years. Now, there's an answer to both those problems, and that is to launch something that is like the New Deal, that's like the kind of economic urgency that we had when we had to prepare for World War II. Put people to work retrofitting buildings, energy conservation, building renewables. That's going to solve the unemployment problem. That's going to be, it's the only way we're going to prevent the climate crisis. And we are not able to do that because the entire political system, both political parties, are dancing around talking about a virtually non-existent problem, which is a debt cliff, a cliff that we're about to fall off when interest rates are historically low, and it's the same lack of agreement between the two political parties over priorities that has led to what Professor Nisbet correctly says, this problem has been growing over a long period of time. They have disagreed. One side wants tax cuts for the wealthy and military spending. And the other side, hopefully, pretends at least that it wants to have some domestic spending and domestic programs. They keep fighting over this. One side fights playing hardball. The other side can't decide whether it wants to fight and doesn't fight very convincingly. And that's what's landed us in this situation.
So, Steve, do you have any response, or should we go to another caller?
Well, go ahead to another caller, and we'll see what comes up.
Let's go to the Rush. You're on the air. Hi, Rush. Welcome.
Happy Veterans Day to everybody.
Same to you.
This is an anniversary for you and I, of course, because the very first time I heard your show and called you, it was a Veterans Day, and you were attempting to read the letter written by Sullivan Ballou to his wife on the eve of his death.
Yes.
That I won't forget. But for your current guest, let me say first to the lady to call about Social Security. Lyndon Johnson took the Social Security surplus, what Social Security at the time did have a surplus, to pay for the war in Vietnam. And from that day to this, every president since him has used the money to balance the budget and put in a bunch of IOUs, and therefore we have no Social Security surplus. All that money, although it's labeled FICA, FICA, and FIT, federal income tax, federal excise tax, it goes in the same pot of money to pay the general revenue bills. Now, I just want to ask you guys this question.
Sure.
In all the economic courses I've ever taken, when productivity went up, wages for workers went up. In the last 5 years in this country, we're up 10% in productivity, but wages are stagnant to going south. Why is that?
Well, again, it refers back to a problem I talked about earlier, and that is that a lot of the productivity increases that have been made by labor are due to the fact that we're working with a lot of technology. So, for example, an accountant who used to sit down and do accounting by hand is now doing it on a microcomputer. So where you used to need 10 accountants, now you can do the work of 10 accountants with one, and that one accountant is hugely more productive. But because we also compete in a global labor market and wages here are highest in the world and wages in other places are much lower, a lot of that labor has migrated by way of the technology. So we're, you know, so part of the other reason we see low wages is that we're competing in a global labor market. The real hidden danger here, Mark, to get back to the question that was raised before the caller came in, is that and my colleague made a point here that interest rates are very low. And, you know, what's very sinister here that's not being discussed, I think, is the prospect of high inflation in this economy. And, you know, a lot of economists, a lot of financial economists in particular, are asking each other, well, why don't we see the inflation? We've gotten through this last 4 years by virtually doubling the money supply, and the monetary base, the base that we build the money supply on, is actually larger than that. If you look at the recovery here, once you take the effect of inflation out of the GDP growth, there has been no recovery. We've flatlined, basically. We're not quite back to where we were before we crashed in 08. And, you know, we haven't had any deflation in this economy dating back to the 1930s. So prices have gradually increased to the point where, you know, the real income of the average consumer has been going down now for this entire decade. And, you know, this is a huge problem when it comes to quality of life. You know, I don't disagree that there are significant issues that we have to deal with the, you know, with the environment, for example, and that there aren't things that we could do there. I hesitate to recommend something similar to a New Deal because I have to ask, well, where is that money coming from if we continue to borrow? The reason the government has been able to borrow at such low rates for such a long time is that, you know, we've had the Fed just pushing money into the system.
So this again, needs a longer discussion. We only have like a minute and a half left here. And I, Robin, we really have about a minute left. But I'd like you to respond to that last part, if you will, just for a minute.
Yes. Look, the real problem here is that we have the U.S. economy has – productivity has grown in the U.S. economy for the past 30 years. It's grown quite a lot, actually. And the truth of the matter is, it turns out that practically the entire increase in productivity over the 30-year time period has been captured by the very, very top income bracket. Let's use Occupy language. Call it the 1%. The 1% has basically gobbled up practically all of the productivity gains in the U.S. economy for 30 years. That's why wages haven't gone up. Now, the whole idea that, well, it's because labor's productivity hasn't gone up, but somehow the productivity of capital has gone up. Human beings have always worked with machines. When we have better and more machines to work with, the productivity of our work with those machines is what goes up. And for people who are in such an economy, we deserve to share in that.
So
and 99% has not been sharing in that, and that is why we have the situation that we have regarding the you know, that living standards are you know, haven't grown for the vast majority of the population.
So Robin Hill has had the last word, at least for this evening, but we will come back to this and look forward to having both these men back and others as well. Dr. Robin Hunnell is visiting professor of economics at Portland State University. Dr. Steve Nisberg is associate professor of finance at the University of Baltimore. And we'll come back to this in the coming weeks as we see what is going on. And this has been a really interesting conversation. It's good to have interesting and different viewpoints here on the air. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you for creating the forum for the discussion. This is really important, Mark, so thanks.
Good to have you both with us. On the way to our break, I'm going to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Hospital for Children, offering primary, specialty, and critical care for all children, from the smallest babies to the biggest teenagers. For more information or to learn about their specialty outpatient locations throughout the state of Maryland, call 1-800-492-5538. Stay with us. We'll be right back to Honor Veterans Day.